So I'm going to tell you today about a system that we've picked up in our lab. This is a relatively new system. And our attempt to try to understand it basically in the context of the things that I've been learning from all of you about memories. The system that we'll be looking at are colloidal gels. And the way that we're going to be looking at them is using a confocal shear cell that we've built. So the confocal shear cell is this movie. The basic idea is that you confine a colloidal suspension between two plates. You use the bottom plate to shear it. We have actually triaxial control in the shear plate. And we're not going to make use of this, but we also have a force sensor that allows us to detect the strains in the various directions. And the thing that's nice about this shear cell is that we're able to tune the gap, and so we've been able to look at confined suspensions as well. The system that I'll tell you about today is kind of like the one on the right. All the images that I'm going to show you are sort of XY planes, and so you're going to see stacks of these confocal images. And well, let me get into it and tell you what it is that we see. So by no means are we the first ones to say that when you take a colloidal gel and shear it, you change its structure and mechanical properties. This is something that's been known for quite a while, and these are just a few of the more recent studies. We were particularly inspired by George Pitakidi's work at Forth, where they looked at oscillatory shear. And there, what they did was they used simulations to try to understand what's happening at the microstructure, but the advantage in our system is that we can directly look. And so this is what I'm going to tell you about today, is what do we see when we apply oscillatory shear to these gels. We're also inspired by the work of Golub, Pine and company, I think Brady, where they showed that a suspension of non-Brownian particles is irreversible when you have a large enough strain, and that these systems tend to collide with one another until they reach what's known as an absorbing state, where the system can then shear back and forth without any of the particles bumping into one another. So if you took a stroboscopic image of the suspension and you looked at it, you would see that initially the particles are changing in time, but then after you get to a state that's absorbing, the suspension returns to its initial configuration without change, and so what you end up seeing is a static image, okay, if you're using a stroboscopic imaging right at the point of no shear. Is that system familiar to people? Should I go through that a little bit more? People know about this? Okay, so we're going to do something similar, but we're going to do it with colloidal gels, and the idea is the following. You take a gel that's formed in between your plates, and now you strain it, and the gel will break. And then you bring it back, and the gel will reform, and break, and reform, and break, and reform. And the question is, can you embed memories in the same way, but now in a gel system that we are investigating? Okay, so here's our system. We have silicon particles, silicon oxide particles. We have a glycerol and water solvent, about 80 times more viscous than water. It helps us image the particles more cleanly. We put in fluorescein dye into the solvent so the particles appear black in an otherwise fluorescent background. And we have some salt, and the salt allows us to tune the DLVO potential so that we have a secondary minimum, and that means that the particles can fall into this minimum. This minimum is not the van der Waals deep well that would make the suspension crash out and be irreversible. In this minimum, you form a weak gel, which you can then break apart as you shear. Okay, is that clear? All right. And the volume fraction that we'll be investigating is about 35%. Don't ask me why we chose that. I think that was the first stable one that we found, so we glom onto things that work very tightly, because nature is really tough. Okay, and then what we're going to do is we're going to shear this system, and every time we return to the original point where there's no applied strain, we're going to take an image, we subtract successive images, and we back out where the changes have occurred. So this is a threshold intensity difference between the original image and one right after one cycle of shear. Okay, and so what I'm going to plot for you is what this intensity looks like as a function of time. That's sort of the idea. And to see whether or not we can get to something that's nearly black. All right, so this is the mean image difference. And we're going to do a strain sweep. So this is an amplitude sweep where we, at each point, shear at that strain for 5 cycles. And then we record the average image intensity difference. And what we see is that as we increase the strain, we see more and more image difference, and that's sort of what you would expect for a normal system. You shear more, you get more change. Yeah? Now, I'm going to show you what happens when we train the gel, and what I mean by that is that we choose an amplitude where we go back and forth many, many, many times, and this is what the movie looks like. So this is, again, an XY plane, one of these planes in the gap, and we're going to look as a function of time what happens, and you see initially there's quite a bit of change, but after many, many cycles, what we find is that this gel basically adopts what we would call an absorbing state, where nothing is really changing anymore. Okay, so that's...
This is stroboscopic?
Yes, stroboscopic.
And, yeah, how many stroboscopic images did you just see?
Okay, so what we're looking at is the mean image difference is a function of shear cycles, and this is about 500 cycles to get it there. Now, obviously, most of the action is happening at the beginning, but it does relax. We have fit this to exponentials. We don't quite yet have all the scaling stuff. We're working on that, but again, this looks basically like the same stuff that you're used to. Okay? Okay. And so now you can do a memory readout. And so you do exactly the same experiment. You shear at each strain for 5 cycles. And this time, what we see is, after the gel has been trained, that you reach a memory threshold, and then only beyond there does the system change. Now this is, yeah, so that's the memory that we're embedding in the gel. Okay, any questions? I think we're still using the same language that everyone's used to. Okay, what about if the amplitude, the training amplitude, is too high? So here what we see is a gel that is being sheared with a very large strain amplitude, and what you see is that the system never settles down. It just constantly rearranges. It can never find an absorbing state. What about if we have a very low training strain? So here's a system where we're applying a very, very small amplitude, and it really doesn't look like anything is happening. So the question is there any memory readout in something like this? So here it is, the training as a function of the strain amplitude. So this is the first image that I showed you, or something like it. You basically have, at medium strain, you get this drop-off in the mean image difference, and then you can read out the memory. You go to high strain amplitudes, we get no drop-off in the mean image difference, and the two curves, the strain sweep, doesn't show any difference between the trained and the untrained system. Whereas at low strains, even though we can't pick it out because our noise floor is too high, it still looks like we get a memory in that system as well. Okay, so as long as you're oscillating by a little bit, this works. And if we don't oscillate at all, is that your question?
Yeah, what's happening at the end of
here? At the end of here? Here. You stop shearing, and so there's no image difference. Yeah? It's a theorist, I gotta explain everything. Okay, so if we don't apply any strain whatsoever, you don't get this memory. So even though it doesn't look like we're applying something, we are, and when we don't apply any strain, we just let it sit there for the same amount of time, what you see is that the system, if anything, you get more changes as a function of time. It may mean that aging is a slightly different thing from memory formation. I don't know. Okay? Any questions about this? Yeah?
The middle one, where you're saying there's a memory, I assume the green line is...
The green line is the training amplitude.
And so it doesn't look like it's shifted from where that green line is.
What can I say? These are experiments. You know, you have a green line here, for example, that's not at the same spot. I think this one, I would say, is more a question of the noise. If I follow this down, then you might get it to happen right at the green line. So, you know, I think you're seeing the signatures of the thing that we're talking about, but in experiments, you know, maybe even the readout protocol is giving you some training, right? Because we're doing it for 5 cycles.
So if you went to different gamma 0, you would see that thing shift?
Yeah, that thing does shift. Eric is the one who did all the experiments, so he's going to correct me as we go.
Oh,
other comment on that. This one in the middle didn't reach a totally reversible state. It gets, you know, close to zero range, but not quite. So it's, that's partially the reason for it.
Yeah. Okay.
So on that, have you sort of looked at how these relaxation curves look at the constraints?
Yeah. So this is as a function of different strains. And so these relaxation curves, I see, you're saying within this range, have we looked at the shape of this? Yes, but I don't have enough data to tell you if the thing diverges as we get to the critical strain and things like that. So we're still working on that part. Like I said, this is a relatively new system, so we're just getting our footing. But I anticipate that there will be something like that in this system. Okay? And I'll try to save all my final thoughts on things that we haven't done towards the end. Okay, good? All right. Okay. So I think we're on our way to establishing this as another memory system. But now I want to sort of veer a little bit because I want to sort of put our own little signature on these studies and try to think about a little bit more deeply what are the underlying structures that are giving you this memory. And so the rest of this talk is not exactly complete, but it's an attempt to formulate some disorganized thoughts in my head and put them on paper and see what you all think about them. All right? So what we want to do is we want to think about what structures are actually contributing to the memory formation in these materials. In other words, if I take a look at an untrained system and a trained system, can I say something about the difference at the underlying, at the particle level? And to do that, we need to do a slightly more difficult experiment. So instead of sitting at one height and just measuring the image difference, now we're going to start tracking, like imaging the entire, or at least a good portion of the gel, and start tracking the particles, and then looking at what the particles are doing. Okay? If we look at the mean displacement of the particles as a function of shear cycles, it shows very similar behavior to the mean image difference. And these points are where we're going to take our images. So we don't get to take images all along here. That would be too long of a PhD. But if you do it once every, you know, however many, then you can, you know, get a long way to understanding the structure. Okay. Again, if you use the mean displacement as a function of the effective strain now, so we can measure the actual strain in our system, so slip does occur, you get about 5% slip, but in this system we can measure the actual strain that's being imparted, and so this is what we're reporting here, and again, you see the untrained versus the trained system show a clear signature of memory formation. And so we want to try to understand what it is about the structures in these systems that are allowing them to retain that memory. Okay, so here's the gel structure before, and here's the gel structure after, and as usual, it's bloody hard to tell what is different between these two. Okay, so we have to work a little bit harder. We can do things like measure the pair correlation function, and we do see that you get an extra population of particles with more contacts in the stable network. Okay, so as we train the gel, you see that the first peak in GFR increases, but okay, I don't know how much insight that really gives. We also measure the contact number, so the number of particles that are in contact, and again, that shifts, that sort of reflects the peak in G of R. This now tells you a little bit more about the distribution of contact numbers, and it's quite broad, and so again, I'm not really seeing what we can tell from this. And so I think we need to look a little bit harder and try to think about the local structure. Okay, so here is a gel, and I'm just going to, it's one section in our system, but now this is a section in the vertical direction, so it's in the shear gradient plane. So if I'm shearing the system this way, I'm looking at a plane in that direction, and so I'm going to go back and forth, and you know, it's kind of hard to see anything. You may want to take a look at this sort of loop here, okay, so there's a loop, and if I go back and forth, you see that loop preserved, although straining a little bit. Okay, so that's kind of the type of motions that we're able to pick out when we image the gel when it's not strained versus strained. Okay, so these are the kinds of structures that are holding on to the behavior. And so, you know, again, these are not very large differences that we're talking about, but it did start to get us thinking about, you know, what it means to have a structure that can be able to strain. In other words, if I think about constraints in a system, I can think about systems that are isostatically rigid. In some sense, the gel has to be able to maintain its rigidity. But then there are systems that are over-constrained and systems that are floppy. And my contention is that if you want to be able to maintain a memory, you need to be floppy enough to maintain that memory. And so that means that as we start our experiment, even if we have particles that are in this rigid configuration, somehow the training protocol must be getting them into this floppy mode where they can sustain that stress. Not stress, they can sustain that applied strain. Okay?
Is that inconsistent with your contact number increasing?
We're not sure yet, and I'll tell you why we're not sure yet in a second. Okay, so there is a... So if I... Well, okay, let me continue my thought process. But, you know, if I think about a chain of particles here, right, and a chain of particles here, it's not clear to me that if I break this chain that I'm, you know, whether I'm increasing or decreasing the number of contacts. In other words, if these things are rigid, right, then I'm putting more particles into that. So it's really not, I don't want to look at the immobile versus mobile particles, I want to look at the hinges and the constraints. And so it's a little bit more difficult problem than just looking at the network. I want to know where are the weak spots in the network. That's my best way of answering that. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So how stiff should I really think of these structures, though? Because you've got a shallow well, and as you deform it, do you actually push it in and out of the well, or are they really bars, or are they sort of rubber band?
Yeah. So the well is, you know, roughly speaking, 100 nanometers in extent. So it's pretty small on the size of the particle. On the other hand, all of these particles have a centrosymmetric potential, so they can rotate around each other. And the structures themselves, you know, unless you have other particles that are constraining the chain, they could be quite floppy. So I'm not sure. I mean, so this is, again, what I'm, everything I'm telling you here is coming out of here, and I'm just trying to put it up on the board and try to get a discussion or learn more about this as the week goes on. But the idea is that if I take one of these chains and I start to abstract it as a loop of some sort, then I can start to ask, well, what sort of things would make loops of different sizes? You know, do I choose this kind of configuration, or do I choose a chain that is much larger? What sort of issues would I want to know about? So, for example, if I have a strain that's quite large, then I'll be stretching all of these loops into lines. And one thing that's clear is that the area swept by these loops is much smaller than the area swept by this massive loop. And so if I think about loop distribution, I think the strain would be something that would tell you should move from things like this to things like this as the strain increases. On the other hand, in our system, we have shear rates that are determining whether or not a bond breaks. So for example, if I have a high fluid shear rate, then that gives me more force to rip apart the bond. And in that scenario, smaller loops are preferred compared to large loops. So in our system at least, I expect there to be a strain rate dependence that tells me, you know, if I can break bonds really easily, then I should start to move the distribution more towards these things than these things, versus if I'm at the quasi-static limit and it's just the gel bonds that are dominating, then maybe I move it more into here. And I don't quite know, you know, anything, I haven't thought about it more deeply than that, okay? And I should say that the strains that we're applying are only 20%, so I'm not sure how much this argument really even, you know, matters for this kind of behavior, okay? Here's one more thought that I had. I asked Eric to image these loops within our gel, and so he took an X Z slice that is 1 micron thick. So now I'm looking at a slice. Again, here's the shear gradient plane. So we're looking at this plane, but I'm only taking a slice that's a micron thick. And you see there's no loops, right? Here's a 2 micron thick. Here's 3. Here's 4. Okay, so it's not until you really get to something like 4 microns that you actually see any of these loops. And so the reason that's interesting is that it tells you that these load or these memory-sustaining chains or loops are not in plane, they're actually tilted. And what that suggests is that if I train a gel in one direction, I should be able to sustain a memory in an orthogonal direction. In fact, you should be able to sustain a memory in the axial direction as well. So anything that makes the system more floppy and able to sustain a strain in one direction should also work for the other two. Okay, so that's a conjecture, and you know, I just thought of this over the weekend, and or Eric and I just thought of this over the weekend, and so he'll go back after this conference and we'll let you know next week. But that's a prediction. Yeah, you had a question, Sue? 2 microns.
Yeah. So it's a whole part.
Yeah.
And when you take the slices, you say you see, the, certainly in the projection, it looks like it gets filled in.
Right.
But it really is a, when you do a slice by slice, it really is a loop.
Let me show you how we're going to try to figure that out. So all of these images, all of this stuff is done in the sort of typical Crocker-Greer tracking algorithms. And I think that those algorithms are not going to be enough to figure out what's going on in terms of the connectivity and things like that. So why is that? So if I look at, so this is the part of the talk where precision matters. So if I take a look at these, the red particles here are the ones that are changing, and the blue particles are the ones that are static, the ones that are reversible. And what you can see is that, you know, they switch around a lot. And so the issue is that our tracking algorithms, it turns out that there's a lot of problems with them when you have particles that are close together, and they tend to distort the image. And so let me tell you a little bit about that and how we're trying to get away from the typical routines that give you about 200 nanometer precision when you have particles that are close together to systems where the potential range is at 50 nanometers. So it's important to know if you're in contact, you have to be able to resolve that length. Okay, so what we've been working on in my lab is a technique to turn our microscope images into something more like an SEM image. And the question is, what is preventing us from making very precise measurements using microscopy? It turns out that if you do the information theoretic calculation, we should be able, with confocal microscopy, to detect particle positions and radii with nanometer precision. And so the question is, why haven't we? And the answer is, well, images are complicated. And so we've constructed a technique that allows us to get to the information theoretic limit by simulating the image. And so the way this works is that you're going to make a computer model of your experimental image that incorporates various features that bring in noise into the tracking algorithm. And so we start with a Platonic idea of what our suspension is, spheres with particular radii at particular locations. And on top of that, you have to include things like the uneven illumination that you have in your microscope, the uneven point spread function, which distorts the images. And once you incorporate these in, pixelation, that also matters. Once you incorporate these in, you can reconstruct an image on the computer that exactly matches the image in the experiment minus the noise. So you simulate an image, you then compare. If we get it wrong, we go back to the simulation, change some of the positions, the radii, compare, change some of the illumination parameters, compare, until we get an exact match minus the noise. Once we have that, then we know we've reached the information theoretic limit, and that allows us to detect particle positions to nanometer precision. In the best case, when the particles are fully static, in the case where we're shearing them, it looks like it's increasing to about 10 nanometer precision, right? 30 maybe. We can also detect the particle radii. So this gray sphere is meant to represent the size of the particle. And this very tightly peaked Gaussian here in red is the measured radius that we have for the particle, and we're nearly reaching the Kramer-Rao bound for the information theoretic limit, which is in green here. So we can now detect the positions and the radii of our particles, and that allows us to figure out whether or not two particles are connected, whether they have a bond between them, or are they just really close by, which doesn't count. And in these gel systems, that's a very difficult thing to like tease out, and that's why we needed to go to this kind of technique. Right? So I don't have results for this yet. We're just starting. I have a little bit of playing data that Eric was able to get done in a mad rush for this conference. And so I'll show you a few things for a very reduced height and extent of our sample. So this is our technique applied to this red region over here. Immediately, you see that the probability of having displacements of a certain magnitude, the probability distribution function, starts to look probably more multimodal. And as we shear or train the system, you start to drive more and more particles to this region over here, where that's sort of like below our threshold, where we don't see anything changing. Okay, so that's how that distribution shifts. And now we can go back and start to think about, okay, well, if we identify these particles, what does their structure look like, as opposed to the blue particles, which are the ones that are stationary. And we've started to look at things like the mean contact number of the red particles. I still feel like we're going to need to work harder to get at whether or not these are hinge particles or ones in the main part of the chain. We're trying to think about how to do that. If people have algorithms for figuring things like this out, we're very interested in speaking with you. How am I doing on time?
You have 15 minutes.
Is that with discussion, without? How do you?
That includes, your speaking time is 45, so you still have 15 minutes of speaking.
And then there's 15 minutes of discussion? Okay. Okay. Good.
We can have more discussion.
Good. Okay. I'll tell you one other technique that, yeah, Shri. Arbitrary. Yeah. Right. So we're trying to make a cut right around 50 nanometers, which is where we expect the bonds to be. But it's true. We don't know where to set that exactly. And it could be that all of this is really, good enough to be in contact, but 0.1 seems a little bit long. I can actually, so one of the things that we want to know is, like, where do we put that cutoff? In order to do that, we have to measure the potential between the particles. And so I'm about to show you how we're going to try to do that. Ajay.
What protection of immobile particles and mobile particles? Immobile look very cute from your images.
There's a lot of mobile particles in the beginning. Okay, so all of these red are mobile. And as you train the system, they all go to the immobile. Yeah, once you've reached 150, there's very few particles that are mobile.
And these are stroboscopic.
Yes.
And so
based on the way you're thinking about this, would it make sense actually to look at movement, maybe pairwise movements during the cycle?
I'm not quite seeing it. Why pairwise movement?
It's
right. Yes. Right. So that's exactly the kind of thing that we're trying to do. Is we're trying to get networks. So Eric is now working on an algorithm to essentially connect the centroids of the particles that are in contact and see how these chains are changing. And so we're going to measure the chain distribution in these mobile particles and see if their topology or is different, or their connectivity is different when they start to become immobile. So it's exactly those kinds of ideas. But I have to say, this is like a new world for me. So any advice that you have, I'm happy to take.
Well, I have a final question, Itai. So based on the contacts, where does the contact information come in defining your mobile and immobile?
I haven't told you exactly yet. So this right now is arbitrary. We put it at around 50 nanometers, where we think the range of the potential is. But the next thing will tell you how we're going to try to quantify it. Okay? Any other questions? Yeah, Robin.
I wanted to ask you, instead of measuring your pair correlations radially, can you tease it out x and y so we can really see what's happening? Because it seems clear they're different.
Oh yeah, so the pair correlation function, you know, we do lots of work on looking at the anisotropy of the pair correlation function. But the pair correlation function is an average over all the particles. So you're not distinguishing mobile versus immobile. You're not distinguishing the hinges versus the, you know, the main parts of the chain. So I think it's still not going to give you very much. My main point in putting that up is that you see a little bit of something, but it doesn't really tell you very much about the structures that are sustaining the strain.
Okay, and the bond angles, would that be captured by the same way we measure hexagon order, that phi 6
order? The phi 6 will measure how many particles are around your central particle and whether or not they're in the right angles. I don't quite see how that is going to help us here, but I may not be fast enough up here.
I don't know.
Yeah. Good. All right. Okay, so let me tell you one last thing that we've been working on in my lab, which is methods for measuring forces using images. And so in this piece, I'm going to tell you how we turn our microscope into a pressure gauge. So in our silica particles, we have a DLVO potential. And this particular study, this is a technique that we developed or that we used our sensitive imaging for, but the particles did not have a secondary minimum. So this is just repulsive particles. And what we do is we measure in experiments the surface-to-surface separation between the particles. And it's important to measure the surface-to-surface separation rather than the pair correlation function because our particles are polydispersed. In fact, everybody's particles are polydispersed. They just, you know, we just claim that they're monodispersed. But if you have 1% or 2% or 5% difference, that can affect your distribution. So we measure the surface-to-surface separation. In other words, we fit the particle size and we fit the other particle size, and so we know exactly how far away their surfaces are. And from that, we can construct a separation probability as a function of the surface separation. And the data are in the dashed lines over here. Okay? That's from our imaging technique. If you try to fit that surface-to-surface separation, that will depend on the potential between your particles. Okay? So if you have a hard sphere potential, this is what you would get for that surface-to-surface separation. If you had a, if you used Crocker and Greer, this is what you would get, so this purple dashed line. And instead what we do is we run simulations and we try to fit this, and from that fit, we can then extract the DLVO potential just by imaging our particles in our system. Okay, so we image the particles, we fit the DLVO potential. In this particular case, you have a drop-off roughly at, you know, 1 over E at 10 nanometers. And so now the idea is that with the secondary minimum, you know, could we pick out a minimum here somewhere around 30 to 60 nanometers? And so this will be a slightly easier task for Eric to do because the particles can remain static as we're measuring this. But the idea is you just look at the particles, see they're jiggling at the nanometer scale precision, look and try to measure that minimum in the DLVO. That should tell us the extent and the cutoff that we should place for which particles are really in contact. Okay? Yeah?
How spherical are your pair particles?
How spherical are they?
Aspherical.
Aspherical. They're pretty spherical. The way that we would say they're spherical to within the noise in the system, and the reason we know that is that if they were aspherical, then you would get little blue and red splotches of where the simulated image does not match the experiment. So the nice thing about this technique is that if you don't match, then you can tell that you're missing something, and then you have to include it. And so if we had asphericity, we would need to include an asphericity parameter as well as an orientation angle, and then we would have to fit the image again with all of those angles and then see where we match. But, right. Emanuela.
I was wondering whether you guys
Exact pattern of what? Yeah, that's a good question. We haven't done it, so I don't know. In this particular system, we took many, many images in time. These particles were moving and were adopting different configurations. In this case, what I think we'll do is we'll have the gel sort of mixed up, or we'll just look at different locations within the volume. Two microns. These are the same. Did Brian use the same part? Maybe one to two microns. They're all the same. The precision does depend on the size of the particle. Actually, the bigger the particle, the more points you have to fit, and the larger, the more precise you can be.
No, I'm just wondering how surprised I should be that they're giving the balance in distilled water two microns.
No, Peclet is like 60, you said? Yeah. I see. We can measure the Brownian motion. I don't have it here. Do I have it here? Yeah. So this is the mean square displacement of our particles as a function of time. And we can measure it no problem for are 1 to 2 micron particles. And the nice thing about being really precise is that you no longer have that cutoff at small. You really go down nearly to zero. Okay? Okay, good.
But the surface potential, is it under shear or is it as a standalone surface?
This one is just standing alone. And we haven't done it for the particles that I'm telling you about. This is for a different system without any attraction. Okay? So we're in progress. The idea is to do this for Eric's particles, figure out where that cutoff should be, and then we'll be able to place that distinction between blue and red particles more easily. Okay? So what I wanted to do today is give you a taste for the kind of system that we have, the kind of tools that we can bring to bear on that system, and then hopefully through discussions during the week, you can tell me what to measure and what sort of things would be useful to characterize as we go forward. Okay? I have just a couple of thoughts about other systems that have similar behaviors. Okay? So I thought I would throw this out as well. So this is still taken from Sri's discussion that we held last Friday. And basically, the idea was that if you have, this is the Golub and Pine experiment, where you have non-Brownian particles in a viscous flow. And again, if you train it, so this is Sid's idea and Nathan's measurements, that if you train the system at a certain amplitude, you can instill a memory in it. If you train it in two different amplitudes with a particular protocol, you could even instill two memories in it, so long as you haven't reached the final memorization state. And so the question there would be, what would take the place of a sort of rigid floppy loop that I have in my gel structure, right? What would be the analog to that? And in some sense, it's, to me, there's this issue of the loop as it stretches, how much area it sweeps, and that gives you some indication of whether or not your system is going to be reversible at some amplitude, right? So the particles, if you think about the non-Brownian particles in that suspension and you somehow connect loops, you know, as they strain, those loops are sweeping out an area. So is that an analog structure in some ways to the gel struts that are sweeping through? So maybe I'll leave it there and leave that as a tantalizing question. Okay, so the research that I told you about was mostly done by Eric. He's sitting right here, so please catch him during the week and talk to him about his system. This is the rest of my group. This is Ithaca and what it looks like every single day. beautiful, which is why we're here in Santa Barbara. And these are some of the works that I've been telling you about in this talk. So thank you.
first question, and then you're going to be the question, the microphone person for this half of the room.
Okay, thanks. With respect to the first part of the talk, I would expect that the kind of structures that could be stable under some oscillatory shear would be formed by having tetrahedra that themselves form into hinges. Because, okay, the tetrahedra are stable, and then the hinges can be have the right flexibility. It would be interesting to look for tetrahedra because it's particularly simple because you can look for the angles in addition to knowing the contact number. So I wonder if you've looked for tetrahedra.
So we haven't. I guess I'm not sure what to think about in terms of stability in general. We don't see that things become, I don't know how to say it. It doesn't seem like the chains are becoming thicker and thicker. So it's possible that we're thickening it up to the point of tetrahedra per chain, because then everything is roughly stable at that scale. So it might be a good thing to look at. Yeah.
So in your work, you assume more or less that when these floppy loops would break, when those bonds break, that the memory is lost, and because the connections have to stay. Now, in our work, and I have a poster later, we see that even when you have gel networks, even when you break them and you oscillate them and they come back to state, sometimes connections between exactly the same bonds are formed. So there could be also some memory, you know, even when you break these loops.
Possible. I mean, I guess what I'm thinking of is some sort of dynamical system that is pushed into loops that can sustain the strain. And so you're breaking things until you get something that can be floppy enough for that strain amplitude. And how that distribution of structures forms and gets there, I'm not exactly sure. So it's possible that there's many cases where the particles do return to their original bonds. I think at the end, you really do see something that stays relatively coherent. So not much is, breaking. You know, it's hard to come back to exactly the same place that you were at, right? So these things really do have to stay nearly, perfectly connected.
I was wondering, you did mention the dependence on the shear rate, so I was wondering what do you know about the viscoelastic spectrum of the gel before and after the training, so like the frequency resolved response?
So one of the issues with this system is that it's embedded in a pretty viscous solvent, so if you measure the forces, you're only measuring the forces of the solvent. So in some sense, this is, you might think of it as a completely useless system. For practical reasons. So it's it's a model system for trying to understand memory formation. I do have to say, we were hired by Xerox to do this work, and what they care about is their toners. It turns out that there's a gelation process for their toners, and they want to know if by processing their pre-mixture differently, they could affect the structures of those toners. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the useful part of this.
I was wondering whether your training amplitude, what do we know, is it in the linear regime, or do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know how to determine that. It's 20%, so that could be well out. I think it would depend, for example, on the volume fraction of the suspension and the particular structures that are formed. Because
if you do G prime and G double prime as a function of gamma, does it occur before the crossover?
That's what I was saying, that it's embedded in a fluid, a really viscous fluid. So it's all G prime dominated. You can't see the signature of the gel at all. So it's not like a robust viscous gel. It's a colloidal model gel. We could make the volume fraction higher, and at that point you might see the rheological signatures of the gel, and then you could start to ask those questions. Or you could make the particles smaller or the fluid viscosity lower, but then we have problems imaging. So our approach is usually to go after the systems that are within our imaging range to be able to investigate how these structures are changing.
So Yeah. How low in density can you go in practically?
Yeah.
And isn't that the more interesting regime to explore?
So when you go to too low of a density, so the question is when can you form a connected structure between your plates? And I think you can do it at infinitely low volume fraction. You know, I just need particles that form a string between the two plates. Okay, so I can do that. That's sort of the lowest that you can go. But practically, our particles are silica spheres, and so if you have silica, it sediments, and so it doesn't find this state very easily. So I think it's hard for us to go to much lower volume fractions than what you're seeing.
I see. Okay. Yeah, I guess sort of the structural changes that you're sort of thinking about will become much more easy to see and interesting, I guess, at low volume fractions.
It could be, and you know, we might need simulations to get at that. I think in some sense the rearrangement in the structures would be more easy to see as we get to higher volume fractions, because their chains are bumping into each other and you can see a bigger difference between the initial untrained and the trained system. So you know, anyway, it's just a thought. Yeah.
Hi. I want to ask how stable are these memories? How does it decay in time?
Yeah.
And does that depend on the system size? Also the memory formation. I mean, if you have these loops and you get to a microscopic size that is on the average of this loop size, you might not be able to form memories, for example.
Yeah, that's a good question. So our system is a gap of about 30 microns. So it's possible that the system size is dictating something about the relaxation times. We don't know. For example, if you have a very large loop, you know, you might expect that it would take time for it to chop up into smaller ones. And if our system is constraining the size of the largest loop, then that may be there. So that's certainly possible. We can change our size by, you know, a factor of two smaller, a factor of two larger. But if we wanted to get to much larger sizes, we would probably have to go into a bulk rheometer. So that makes it harder to image the structure, but it might be good for looking at the dependence. And the dependence is exponential. So you get a relaxation time, you can fit it pretty nicely to an exponential plus our noise floor.
And the XY size, I mean, this you can change easily, right? The plane.
Sorry, say again?
The area size.
Oh, the area size?
Yeah, you can have small gels, big gels, right?
Our size laterally is quite large. It's 5 millimeters by 5 millimeters. And we're imaging a very small region in there of about 64 microns squared, like 64 by 64 microns. So laterally, it's pretty large in extent. Remember, we have 30 microns. This is why this experiment is so hard. You know, you're trying to make something parallel over 5 millimeters. And you know, have it vary by less than a micron across the entire gap. So we work really hard to do that, but it's pretty far laterally. Sid.
So I see your system is somehow halfway between the non-Brownian suspensions, which don't have attractions, and then the glasses, which are much denser and always connected. But when I hear people talk about what's happening in the glasses, they always want to talk about localized rearrangements of STZs or whatever you want to go by various names. But and now your picture is somehow, if I understand it, going to be somewhat different from that. Is there any sense in which it would go over to those kinds of behaviors as you make it more dense, or is there going to be some kind of a transition between these different regimes?
Yeah, I don't know. So I'll just say what I think and not worry about the consequences. But I think the idea within the glass, so the STZs for me are the parts that are weak, right? These are the things that are easy to change. But the structure of the glass is borne by the rest of the material. And so in some sense, when you're looking for something that can strain back and forth, I don't know that I care so much about the weak parts. I care about the parts that are sustaining. And if those parts are somehow spindly and percolating through my glass, Maybe it's not so different. And maybe if I think about these struts, you know, that are able to move, they're moving through a material that's a little bit more compliant, in which case you get little tiny energy minima that they get pinned on. And so if I come back to this picture over here that we were talking about, so as I strain my glass, can I think about this type of loop as just a linear sort of Hookean behavior of moving these struts, but then these little tiny minima that you get stuck in are like a viscous granular material that is pinning those structures as you go around. So that's my very vaguely formed idea.
I'm going to jump in and ask a question while I have the mic. So the secondary minimum is actually quite broad. So do you have a sense of whether if that becomes narrower or broader, that makes it easier or harder to form memories? Because I can imagine two effects. So okay. One is that if it gets super narrow, well, not super narrow, but narrower, then a particle might fall out of that minimum and it would lose the memory real easy. Or it might be that actually having a stronger attraction there makes it easier for it to stay in it. I don't even know if that's not terribly accessible, I realize, experimentally.
Right. I mean, so there's two parts to the attraction, right? There's the depth of the well, and I think that depends a lot on things like the shear rate. So what you're trying to ask is
how fast
am I moving it so that the viscous stresses are enough to break that bond, right? So if I have a shear rate dependence, then I think the depth of the well matters. If I'm doing it quasi-statically so that the viscous stresses are gone, then I don't care so much about the depth of the well. It's really the chain that's breaking those. And the distance, even though it seems quite broad, is still only 50 to 80 nanometers. We haven't measured it yet, but I think it's something around there. In which case, you know, that's a pretty small distance, even though it sounds like it's broad. So relative to the, 20% of the particle is like 200 nanometers or 400 nanometers. So it's not an infinitely small fraction of that, but it's there.
Hey, so I'm going to ask the anti-question to SIDS. So you read out these memories by sweeping up the strain amplitude, do much of cycles and with increasing strain amplitude. Is that right? Did I get the right impression?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm wondering if you have looked at the structure much during that readout procedure or whether you just do image distance differences right now.
So you're thinking about this. During the readout.
Yeah.
So this is the point. So we're going to look at the gel at these points during the training. And we're going to look at this.
But are you looking at these structures?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
We're looking at the structures during the readout.
Okay. Because that's I would find that very interesting. You know, your signal is coming not from the stable structures. It's coming from the unstable structures.
Right. That's a good point. So,
and so what are the unstable structures that are breaking up as you go past that?
Good. Yes. We don't know yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But that's right. So we're part of the protocol is to take the images, the stacks during the readout, and to try to analyze which parts are breaking as you approach this memory. Right? So it tells you something, what's different about the structures that are stable versus the ones that are breaking as you approach this point. Yeah.
So I have more of a question of what you can do with this measurements of the contact.
Yeah.
So can you actually construct the contact network and then look for the hinge particles by the ones that are not over-constrained? That's the idea?
That's the idea.
Okay.
So you would look for the ones that have more,
less trust.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. One interesting thought that you've had in the context of granular is there's this dual network of the voids, which is completely dual in the sense that if this is less, the particles are less constrained, the voids become over-constrained.
Yeah.
So the stable and unstable could be
mirror images, right. Okay.
If you have the contact network, I think you can look at
it. Good.
Right. Any other questions?
Just one experimental one is, does anything depend on how fast you do the shearing, that is, or how long you wait between, you know, one shear and the next?
So when we look at this, if we wait the same amount of time, so 900 shear cycles, we see a little bit of a change. So presumably the system is aging. I hate aging experiments because they make me feel old as I'm watching, you know, things go. So we try to stay away from that, just because, I don't know what the answer is, other than to say that it's not changing by too much, but we know that gels age. So we should probably know what that aging time is for this system. There's a viscous solvent, so that does slow things down. It slows the aging down relative to the other gels that you're probably used to.
All right. Thank you, Todd.
Okay, thank you.